We are here. To talk about how neoliberalism rules the world. So, as we have done every week, just a review of last couple of weeks. What questions have arisen or thoughts in the last couple of weeks or from last class even? We covered up to 1980, basically. Or how about this? Is it easier to understand economic news by any chance through this course? Oh! That is so gratifying to hear. Like, any examples?
Like selling arms to Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yeah. That was like a massive deal, right?
And his questioning as to whether the politics involved, whether or not our president bowed to the king. That's important. Of course, I don't know how else. Of course, I don't know how else you put a chain around someone's neck unless they put their head down. So it's going to appear as though they bowed. As far as the media is concerned, that's important.
Around 1850, right? Around then, which is shortly before the Civil War, there was an opium war before the Civil War. And the opium war was Great Britain invading China to force China to receive opium that Britain was cultivating in India and Afghanistan to shove into China. Because, I mean, Great Britain did not care about Chinese addicted to opium. But mostly it was because so much gold had gone to China that the British people, the British government wanted the gold back, but they had nothing to sell to the Chinese that the Chinese wanted. The Chinese had silk, and they had pottery, and they had spices, and all kinds of other things that the West wanted, but the Chinese didn't want anything that the West produced. So the Chinese were selling all these goods to the West, and the West was giving them gold for it. But then they were really, really running low on gold reserves, which is the basis for currency. So they needed a way to get the gold back. And the only thing that they could think of was to sell opium to the Chinese, get them hooked on it. And then when they sell the opium to Chinese, then they get the gold back. So the Chinese government, seeing the kind of addiction problems it was causing among the people, restricted all the ports except to Hong Kong. And opium was going through Hong Kong. But the British were not happy with that. They wanted all the ports open, and all of the opium flooded into the interior. So that's what the opium war is about. And that is the beginning of the breakup of China until, you know, the rise of Mao Zedong and communism in 1949. You see that? This, like, America and Great Britain as Western Christian nations, you know, this is outrageous. This is completely against history. We're for drug addiction. We're for slavery. We're for genocide. We're for anything that will allow us to make a buck, right? No matter what the cost to other human beings or to the environment or to sanity, humanity. So now we get all this oil from Saudi Arabia, but we don't really have anything that a desert nation wants, right? And anything that they can buy from the U.S., they can buy from anywhere else. So we've given so much petrodollars to Saudi Arabia, we need those dollars back. What do we have? Missiles, armaments. So we just, so it's kind of a deal, like it's our drug of choice right now. Is this opium is opium is to Great Britain what armaments are to the U.S. The U.S. as a government is the single largest arms dealer in the world, and we arm friends and enemies. Mm-hmm. We arm India and Pakistan, who are enemies. We arm capitalist and communist countries. We do drug dealers discriminate? Neither do arms dealers. So this is one of the main ways that the U.S. recoups its hard currency. Yes?
The sad thing is that it's just like vicious cycle. Like back in 1908 and, you know, those centuries, mm-hmm. they were colonized everybody. Mm-hmm. And like through treaty meetings, like Portsmouth treaty, that Theodore Roosevelt let Japan conquer Korea.
Yeah.
And, you know, they changed, like State Department of USA changed everything from Korea to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like vicious cycle they do.
Oh, yeah.
It's nothing changed.
Right.
I mean, nothing changed. That's what it's really discouraging.
The United States was a British colony at first. Then it became an independent colony. Then it became an empire on North America, where it expanded westward, right? That's empire. So it became a North American empire. Then it became an international empire. And then it became a neo-empire, meaning empire without boots on the ground, but controlling the economy and the finances of other nations and effectively making them into, you know, slave states. Just like U.S. corporations and the U.S. government have figured out that if we put college graduates, when they're 22 years old, $50,000 in the hawk, that we basically can make them wage slaves for the next 20 years, right? So what comes around goes around, and I just hope our people here know that a $50,000 debt after college is completely arbitrary. We can create a system where that is the norm, and we can create a system where college is free, like many other countries have done. It's completely arbitrary. A nation can provide free health care to all its citizens, as in my home country of South Korea. Or it can make you go bankrupt over an illness, where in this country, health crises are the number one driver of personal bankruptcy, right? You can lose everything over personal bankruptcy. By the way, does anybody have the numbers on this latest arms deal to Saudi Arabia? $110 billion. Do you know how much $110 billion is? It's 110 of $1 billion. Right? How much is $1 billion? $1 billion is 1,000 million. It's $1,000 million? Yeah. Yeah.
Let's just take your salary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 1 million, right? 1 million is barely conceivable for most of us. You know? And now imagine 1,000. Millions, 1,000 millions, and then imagine 110 of that. It's, you know, the average person could not possibly spend $1 billion. We can't even spend $100 million over a lifetime. I mean, you know, we can only drive one car at a time. You could do like Jay Leno and have 40 cars in various garages. Or he can't even have park 40 cars in his own house. He has to, you know, rent garages. But still, even if you own 40 cars or 400 cars, you can only drive one car at a time. No matter how rich you are, your stomach is the same size as everybody else's, basically, right? So this greed that Western-style capitalism induces is just really the most ridiculous and unrealistic thing in the world. It's as if human beings have the appetite of the gods, which we don't. We can only be at one place at one time and do one thing at one time, basically. You know, multitasking is a myth. And we can only eat within the range of the human stomach. There's a little bit of variation in that. But that's all we can do. And yet we've constructed a system where people can consume like the gods. That's a crazy system. Well, now, if you're a patriotic American, selling $110 billion to Saudi Arabia is a pretty good thing, right? We're getting some of our oil dollars back. Hallelujah. That's what they get. You know, one of the things that the U.S. did was to sell expensive weapon systems to Middle Eastern countries, but not show them how to do maintenance. That costs extra, right?
Service contract.
Right. All right. So, yeah, some countries got wise to that and started buying weapons from the Soviet Union, right? So, when it was that. All right. Going to ask Laura to say a prayer for us.
Loving God, thank you for gathering us here tonight. Just ask you would help us understand our world a little bit better, help us to focus our attention, and thank you for the opportunity to learn and grow together as a community and to put our faith into action in this real and sometimes scary world that we live in. Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. All right, we're going to try to cover 20 years tonight, and maybe we can talk beyond that if we have time. It should be a breeze, huh?
Or 100,000 years.
Oh. Yeah, that's true. We cover a lot. Here are a couple of choice quotes from our first two major Western neoliberal political leaders. Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem, said Ronald Reagan, and every Republican politician since. Amen? That began with Reagan. Also, there is no alternative, Margaret Thatcher said, meaning there is no alternative to neoliberal economics. She said that so many times, her nickname was Tina. See? There is no alternative. Tina. Oh, yeah. So Ronnie and Tina were like best friends. I think they were in love neoliberally. You know, I'm not trying to spread rumors, but just neoliberally speaking, they were definitely in love. So the big picture. In the 60s and 70s, the corporate class felt threatened by mass resistance movements and organized labor's power to redistribute wealth. This is an interesting thing that we're saying here. It means that the corporate class felt that their capital, their wealth, was being redistributed by labor. And their wealth should remain their wealth, and labor should be paid a pittance, right? That's what that means. But labor, by organizing together, said, no, we want a share of the profits. Right, so the share of the profits means instead of being paid $7.50 an hour, we want $15 an hour. We want some of that share. And corporate power is like, no, you know, we're the smart ones, and you're replaceable. Like, we're not replaceable because we build the businesses. We come up with the ideas. But you're just a commodity, a labor commodity. So you should be paid dirt, basically. So the neoliberal class, the corporate class, united around neoliberalism as both an organizing philosophy and a political project to restore and expand their power. An opportune moment came with the 1973 to 75 recession. What happened in 1973? Yep, the OPEC oil embargo that made oil prices skyrocket. We talked about that last week. A number of factors, including a sudden spike in oil prices, soon caused high inflation and high unemployment. To reverse the recession, the central banks injected massive amounts of cash into the economy, a typical Keynesian response, but to no avail. In fact, this excessive stimulus only caused a price-wage spiral that made both goods and services and labor increasingly expensive. Both inflation and unemployment got even worse, causing stagflation. Okay. So, high inflation. What is a problem with high inflation? There was a time in the early 80s when, do we have that in here somewhere? We might have taken that back out. But inflation was at something like 13% or more, 14%, okay? That means if inflation for goods and services at about 14%, that means your wages would have to rise by 14% to be able to afford the same thing a year later. Imagine if a car cost, the average car right now costs like close to $30,000, right? Imagine if inflation was rising at 15% a year. That means that that car would cost $34,500 the next year, right? But what if your wages were increasing at 2%? Then that means that goods are 13% more expensive in real dollars next year. So that means you better buy the car now. Because buying it now is like a 13% savings compared to next year if inflation is rising at about 15%, which it was in this time. So people were not buying, basically. I mean, if they could buy, they'd buy it now. But mostly people had unemployment. There was high unemployment. And goods and services were getting more and more expensive. So people were not buying. If you're not buying, you're not stimulating the economy. Right? If you're not buying, then there's no production. And if there's no production, there's even fewer jobs. So it's a vicious cycle. And so the Keynesian tactic usually at that point is for the government to print a lot of money through the Fed and inject it into the economy through the big banks and through tax cuts sometimes and other ways. But that wasn't working. So that's why this was an opportune moment for a new economic idea, neoliberalism, that was developed in 1947, to step in. And remember that in 1974, Hayek, a principal architect of neoliberalism, and Milton Friedman, the most famous disciple, won Nobel Economics Prizes in 1974 and 76. So it had already become mainstream now as an idea. And when Keynesian stimulus wasn't working to overcome the stagflation, the neoliberal said, make way, we'll try this. And Reagan became the politician that stepped into that vacuum. So we'll try to explain this a little bit further now. Since the 1930s, Western governments focused on the demand side of the economy. This meant using the government's power to create money at will to stimulate demand. Since money is most likely to be spent by those who need it, rather than saved by the rich, demand-side economics favored the poor and middle class and was a foundational tenet of the political left. Did that make sense? Like, if I want to stimulate the economy, I'd rather give it to poor people who are definitely going to spend it right away than rich people who are likely to put in savings. See what I'm saying? If you put it in savings, the government has wasted its money because it's not buying anything which stimulates, you know, the economy, right? Because buying something means somebody has to produce it, and then that means jobs and all that. So you don't want money to go to the rich, because if you do it to the poor or working class, it's going to be spent immediately. However, what if you believe that more money to the rich means the rich will take that money and not put it into savings, but put it into industry, like actually use it for enterprise? Oh, I have more money, so I'll open up a new factory, or I'll try this entrepreneurial idea I had, but it's tied up in other businesses, but now I have excess cash because my tax rate went from this high to this, and with that excess cash, I'm going to invest in the economy. Then that will also would have a stimulative effect, right? So that's the next paragraph. The right, however, claimed that government waste, bloated social welfare, and onerous regulations on corporations were the primary reason for stagflation. And remember, stagflation is a combination of high inflation and high unemployment, and that the solution lay in pumping money to the supply side. Primarily through tax cuts for the wealthy, Reagan's strategy was to stimulate a sluggish economy by channeling money to the rich. They supposedly would invest this money in production, by which the new wealth generated would trickle down to the masses. So both strategies are part of capitalism, right? One is to take fake money, government money, that you just kind of print, right? Because the government has the power to print money out of nothing, and give it to the poor and working class, who will spend it immediately, creating demand, or give it to the producer class, who will hopefully, if it works well, invest in productive capacity, like new factories or new businesses that needs to hire employees and then create products that generate demand, right?
First was demand, second one supply.
Right.
So you're trying to differentiate between giving people more spending power so they buy more stuff in the short run versus basically bribing businesses to invest more.
Right. So that was the promise between demand-side economics, which is what we also call Keynesianism, and supply-side economics, which is called neoliberalism, and also Reaganomics in this time. Except this trickle-down turned out to be a cheap trick. In the 80s, corporations and the wealthy got a huge raise, but they did not invest in the economy as promised. Instead, they mostly sheltered their profits in ever-creative and often shady ways. When the Soviet Union and with it global communism finally collapsed in the early 90s, the political class in the U.S. promised that the American people would receive a peace dividend. Indeed, national wealth increased dramatically, partly due to lower defense spending, but it all went to the top. For instance, CEO salaries increased by 400% in the 1990s, while workers' wages increased by less than 5%, and the federal minimum wage decreased actually by 9%, adjusted for inflation. So the peace dividend was basically given to the rich. And then they were supposed to invest that in productive capacity, which they did not. In the 2000s, well, let me just say one thing about Reagan. I believe that the reason why the nation as a whole left a Keynesianism that worked for decades. I mean, it didn't work in the 70s, but it basically abandoned it, was because Reagan really believed that this would work. It wasn't, for some people, it was a ruse, but not for Reagan. He really believed that this would work. And he was an actor by trade. And he had a tremendous amount of charisma and folksy charm. And he, you know, there's nothing more convincing than someone who is sincere, right? And he really sincerely believed that. I think by the time it was apparent that it was not working and never was going to work, he got senile, so lucky him. In the 2000s, the excuse for nothing trickling down was the urgency of a war on terror fought on two fronts, Iraq and Afghanistan. Our patriotic duty was to tighten our belts just a little longer, meaning austerity, and wait for American victory, when we would all finally get the benefits of neoliberalism. Instead, neoconservatives hijacked the national budget for war-making and mass incarceration. So again, in the 2000s, we were promised some benefits, but it just basically went to war. So the neoliberals are economic imperialists, basically, and neocons or neoconservatives are military imperialists. Those are two sides of the same coin, neoliberalism and neoconservatism. They're both within the framework of neoliberalism. In the early 2000s, we heard a lot about neocons, right? Bush Jr., Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz. Who else? Not as he was not. They were hardcore neocons. Yeah. John McCain? No. Yeah, I mean, there were like this hardcore right wing neocon nut job group. So these neoliberal ideas were actualized in the rise of Thatcher and Reagan. Reaganomics would unleash neoliberal economic policies in the U.S. and thus around the world. The housing bubble burst and financial meltdown of 2008 should have been the death of neoliberalism. But the government got taxpayers to bail out Wall Street without an alternative economic system to replace it. Outrage would give birth to new movements like Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, and Standing Rock protests on one hand, and spawn the Tea Party, alt-right, and President Donald Trump on the other. All right, so let's just step back. This is kind of the big picture. Is this making sense? Are there dots we need to connect? Yes.
I have a question. Kind of back maybe in the 1980s with the whole idea of trickle-down, do you feel like maybe like the increase of like robotics in factories helped with that fail of trickle-down because they weren't needing as many workers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like electronics,
changes.
Like so if mm-hmm. all of those electronic inventions hadn't have happened at the same time, maybe mm-hmm. that was part of like the perfect storm?
Mm-hmm. It killed a lot of jobs mm-hmm. in the U.S. that were protected in Europe. They slowed the mm-hmm. path of technological adoption in Europe, which basically let a lot of people keep their jobs as typists for longer than would otherwise been the case. So, yeah, some people got that's one aspect of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not only that, but you got to factor in the international movements of labor.
Migrant labor? The migration labor? Or
in the 80s and beyond, and a lot of our lower income jobs.
Oh, the offshoring of jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that also is a factor
mm-hmm.
in, you know, I mean, you build factories, well, but they're not building them. They're building some of the corporations are building factories. They're not building them here.
Right.
So we're not getting them. So under that system, we're not getting the benefit
right.
either.
Okay.
Both of those are very important factors to mm-hmm. labor. The labor factor is a huge.
Right. I mean, we're saying similar things here, yeah.
Real quick, in the 70s and 2008, you mentioned that the attempt at Keynesian stimulus gave money through the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, banks don't often target lower-income people with their loans, and so oftentimes people they target gave loans to were not people who spent as much of the money they received.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of why the stimulus was less effective,
mm-hmm. yep.
reducing unemployment in the 70s, and it's also part of why it was less effective in 2008 during the, you know, in response to the Great Recession. I mean, it was a Great Depression for the rest of the world.
Yeah, I agree.
It just dropped for the rest of the world.
I agree. All right.
Off the U.S.
Becky?
I guess something like you can, with Reagan, for example, even if he believed in kind of what he was saying was trickle down, like working would not really still be working for the average person. They would mm-hmm. just be satisfied enough. Like mm-hmm. they would still just be getting by. It wouldn't be like mm. they were going to be rich.
Right.
It would just work enough.
Uh-huh.
But that didn't happen either.
That didn't happen either. By the way, one way that efficiency, whether by automation, you know, or by offshoring of jobs where people will work for less pay and therefore, you know, the goods, cost of goods will come down. Corporations are going to get wealthier, right? If you can pay somebody in another country $2 an hour as opposed to $12 an hour, even after shipping, you know, all of the cost of shipping back and forth, you could easily have a huge profit on that. If the U.S., if companies got that profit and then paid taxes to the government, and then the government gave it out as some kind of welfare to people. Okay, you know, your jobs got offshored and your job got automated, so you're without employment, but these companies have that much more profit because of automation, because of offshoring, they got all that profit, they pay more taxes, and we're going to give you a floor of food stamps, basic housing, and things like that. People's lives could still work. But simultaneously, as we gave these corporations unlimited power for profit, right, we also said that welfare means that you're lazy. Recognizing that losing your job is not a form of laziness. You know, your job going to another country or your job going to a computer program is not a form of laziness. It's just a changing economy. And so we were stigmatizing government support, and especially by collapsing the idea of welfare with black people, right? And there was a consensus, even now, you know, not but just changed, that black people are just living off the dole. So, and you know, and the most of the country is white, and we're naturally hardworking, superior people. You know, that was the mythology. So there wasn't that much resistance overall to gutting basic social support, and at the same time, you know, jobs disappearing around the country, and people working worse and worse, and less paying jobs. So it was a double whammy that our society has gone through in the last almost 40 years now.
Didn't the same thing happen around industrialization? Like a promise that everyone would have a lot more leisure time because of all these time-saving devices. An economist even said that.
Yeah.
That, you know, life would, people would have to work less in general, but the same kind of
things have to get worse for a while, then they'll get better.
Right.
Right.
Yes, Glory.
So, tell me if I'm completely off here, but the first one, the demand side, makes, to me, it sounds like it makes an assumption that people who are struggling financially are greedy and want more things. Mm-hmm. And if they do, then it will work. And trickle down assumes that the wealthy will be generous and that they're ultimately good. No?
Well, not exactly. I mean, the first part is not that the poor, the working class, the struggling are greedy. It's that they're living paycheck to paycheck, and they are behind on this and behind on that, and they have delayed fixing their car. Right. So as soon as some money comes, they'll finally get that new tire instead of, you know, hobbling on that, taking a risk. They'll finally do some basic things. They'll finally buy the new sneakers for their children. So it's not about being greedy. I mean, it could be, but the idea is that the poor will spend money on things that they have delayed spending money on, right? And try to catch up. Now, they might buy an unnecessary thing, but that would be a small price to pay to stimulate the economy. And for the rich, it's not appealing to their goodwill. It's appealing to their profit motive. So if I have extra money and I can invest in a new enterprise, a new factory, new machine, or new employees, I'll just make more money. So it was actually appealing to the profit motive of the capitalist class that the neoliberals thought that this would work.
If you get an extra dollar, you can do two things. You can consume it, spend it on for yourself, or you can save it. And typically, conservatives think that when you save money, that means it gets invested. But the Keynesians said, not necessarily. Just because you have the money saved doesn't mean that you are going to take the risk of actually investing it.
Basically, both theories are about human behavior. And generally, Keynesian economics has proven to be more accurate in terms of human behavior, which is poor and working class people are going to spend the money that they get. And neoliberals have been pretty much wrong about the behavior of the rich, which is that in general, not always, but in general, they have not invested the money in production, right? In productive economic capacity. So this is one of the great fallacies. And you'll hear politicians, especially Republican politicians, but not just them, Democratic too sometimes, but without exception, Republican politicians saying, if we cut taxes for corporations and for the rich, they will create jobs, right? So they're like, I'm for creating jobs. I'm a wealth creator. I'm a job creator. But all they're saying is that if we give more money somehow, either through tax cuts or other kinds of incentives, that the rich will, you know, invest in productive capacity. And that simply has not been the case. And that has not been the case since Reagan and Thatcher. And yet they keep insisting that it is because people just don't know. People don't have the knowledge, right? And now we can say to people who say that, that's BS. Show me in history how that has actually happened. Historically, by economic metrics, that has actually not happened as a whole. Oh, yes. So productivity is what workers do, us workers. You know what productivity is? The Bible calls it making more bricks with less straw, right? That's productivity. And U.S. workers have been tremendously productive from 1948 all the way to 2013, almost in a straight line. And yet, wages were shared with workers, right? And right at about 1973, now, the capitalist class keeps all the profits of our productivity. And our hourly compensation has remained flat for 45 years now, right? Pretty much the duration of my life.
200% doesn't mean 200% work more, right?
Sorry?
It doesn't mean it's 200% work more, like maybe 40 hours later.
Let's compare it to 73. We're 143.1% more productive than we were in 1973. In 2013.
It's more like related to the automation of the process? Or?
It's not just, some of it is automation, but we workers can just do so much more than workers could in 1973 because we have so many more tools. Think about how much we communicate in a day. I mean, the communication that an average worker does in one day would be more than communication for a whole month sometimes in 1973. So we're just getting a lot more done because we have assistance and technology makes that possible. But we haven't gotten the gains. Now, I don't know if we say this later, but a couple of reasons why Americans feel like we have actually gained here is, one, we don't understand how inflation works. So when we get a raise, if the inflation is the same, then we're actually not getting a raise. For at least the last 10 years, most of our raises have been at or slightly below the cost of inflation. So when you get a 2% or 3% raise, your corporation is basically looking at the consumer price index and matching it to that. So basically, they're trying to give us not a, what is the opposite of a raise? A pay cut. So our pay raise at the end of the year is actually not a pay cut is what it is. So there's the illusion of a rising wages because we don't understand how inflation works. The other thing is two-income households. Beginning in the 70s, two things happened simultaneously. Two-income households for married people and divorce, right? Very, very similar chart, those two things. So if your wages are flat, and by the way, women in the 1960s and early 70s made 60 cents on a man's dollar. But even if a woman worked full-time, that meant that your household income is going to be 1.6 times what it was before, right? So it seems like the house got a raise. But the cost, the social cost was tremendous. Divorce and the alienation of a whole generation of children, and all the social ills that we see today from that. The breakdown of the family, the breakdown of the church, the breakdown of all of our social institutions, basically. So we've taken upon ourselves, since we haven't gotten a raise as people, we've taken it upon ourselves to give ourselves a raise by working more, you know, as a whole household at great social cost. Kids are next. We're going to have child labor again, right? How are we going to increase, you know,
socialization process?
It's going to be child labor and polygamy. All right, let's move on. Brave new world.
In a quick point on the productivity, too, it's also because of globalization as well, you know, the increase in the web and things like that as well. Like, for example, the Boeing Dreamliner had multiple parts of different parts of the world all come together, and it's made in the USA. You know, things like that as well because of globalization. Because
Boeing Dreamliner, their brand new airplane.
Yeah, the Boeing 787. So they have multiple parts that are manufactured in different parts of the world, and then they all are integrated in one part and things like that as well. So that's globalization and also the influx of skilled labor from the other parts of the world. you know, they come here and then they increase productivity because the rest of the world also, I mean, child labor and stuff is normal, you know, where I come from and things like that. And so people are like grown up, you know, working, you know, 70, 80 hours a week, and then they come into like here and then just being productive in a way. And that also like increases the productivity and then gives competition to Americans in a way. And then we are accused of stealing American jobs too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so stop that. All right. So let's move on to the 1980s. Neoliberal shock doctrine. The neoliberal dream was hatched in 1947 at Mont Pelerin by Hayek and others. We already covered that last week. And aggressively organized following the 1971 Powell memo, a sort of grand strategy for a neoliberal ascension. If you're interested, you can read about that on the internet. He was a Supreme Court nominee appointed by Nixon, who said, we got to take power back from all these mass protest movements. After experimentation in Chile in 1973, that's about Pinochet, neoliberalism became a political reality in the West under Reagan and Thatcher as they presented it as the only alternative to the failure of Keynesian economics. Remember Tina. The late 1970s had witnessed financial chaos, food riots, oil shock, doomsday prophecies of the end of growth, and ecological crisis. Reagan and Thatcher were instrumental in severing the link between rising productivity and rising wages. You know that chart we saw, with the link was severed, right? This link was severed here. And Reagan and Thatcher basically severed it even more. There was no going back. Productivity would continue to rise, but wages stagnate, even atrophy in the 80s. This was temporarily obscured by the rise of two-income households, as we said, and increased use of credit, inflating household debt. Oh, I forgot to mention that. Two-income household and credit card debt. And in the what was really popular in the 90s and 2000s was taking out a second mortgage, right? Or a line of credit on your house. It's like free money because your house keeps rising. So it's not really debt, is it? Or so they told us. All the while, corporate profits skyrocketed. So one of the things we want to talk about is how a new story was basically shoved to us. The wealthy founded and funded neoliberal think tanks. How many of you have heard of, for instance, the Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the Brookings Institution? Right? These are all very, very prominent neoliberal think tanks that are funded by the super wealthy. To pretend that this is just, you know, academic research, impartial academic research. Nope. And what these neoliberal think tanks did was propagate a new ideological and economic narrative, a story, conflating individual liberty with market freedom. So my individual liberty is now tied to corporations' freedom to do whatever the hell they want, right? So now I'm defending corporations. Remember last week we talked about how our enemy, our mortal enemy, was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union represented totalitarian and state control of industry. And we were about individual liberty and free markets. So all of us are good, and those guys are bad. So somehow corporations that are exploiting us are on the good team. And that was very much pushed in this time. And, you know, the Soviet Union was a great, foil, right, to put individual liberty and market freedom together. So individuals are free when they can pursue wealth without government interference. State intervention, it was told to us, is a slippery slope to totalitarianism. So neoliberalism is the only true guarantor of freedom. But individuals are now only free within the limited scope of capitalist values, individualism, competition, and profit. They are not to choose the creation of collective institutions like labor unions. It's un-American. Or to fight politically for societal and environmental needs above the market. you know that in America, free market capitalism is God. Rather, they are free to think and act like a tiny corporation, pursuing profit and taking on debt, only without the protection, tax breaks, bailouts, and subsidies that large corporations receive as a matter of course. The number one recipient of welfare in America are corporations. Let's not forget that, okay? Except when people, poor people get it, we call it welfare, and when corporations get it, we call it subsidies. Yes, Mark.
I kind of see some parallels in what's going on now, where they're talking about all the welfare cuts, but somehow Trump made those people voted for him because mm-hmm. that was like they were pro-America,
right?
And Trump is make America great again.
Mm-hmm.
So then, but then he actually is the one that's cutting their welfare or their mm-hmm. subsidies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird that people are voting not in their own best interest because of because it's American.
Yep, that's a very smart connection. You know how crazy our world is right now? I mean, how many of us have lived long enough to know that to be a Republican is to be absolutely opposed to Russian Soviet Union, right? And now to be a Republican is to be cozy with the Russians. I mean, when was I born that I live in a world like this? That is that reversed that quickly? So that's the story, right? So not in reality, but ideologically, our interests, our patriotic duty became tied to corporate, neoliberal corporate advancement. B, economic policies for the rich. Early in his presidency, Reagan fired 11,000 striking air traffic controllers who are federal employees, gutting the labor movement and empowering corporations even further. He cut the top income tax rate from 70% to 28%. I mean, do you know what a raise that is? Right? That's like getting a massive raise at the end of the year. Okay, American Hustle. It's about a scam called trickle-down. Yes. Now it's up to 39.6%. But remember that for the rich, it's never 39.6%. It's way lower. Why? Because they can take deductions. Anything remotely business-related can be deductible. And how about this? The maximum tax on capital gains went from 35% to 20%. What is a capital gain? Money made on money. Thank you. So you buy stocks on Wall Street, right? And the stocks rise, say, 10% or something. And let's say you put a lot of money in that and you make $100,000. You used to have to give $35,000 at the end of the year if you're rich, right? And you make $100,000 in capital gains, meaning money from Wall Street. You did nothing except just have a lot of money and bet correctly on stocks. When you make $100,000, $35,000 used to go to taxes, federal government. Now only $20,000 goes. And you can deduct from that. When Mitt Romney ran for president a few years ago, we know that all he does is investments. All he does is stock trading, right? So and capital gains on that is 15%. So we knew already that the maximum tax he was paying was 15%. When he finally released his tax returns, how much did he actually end up paying?
5%.
Taxes. No. 13%.
The year he released.
13%, right. Because even from the 15%, he was able to deduct business expenses. So our payroll taxes are at least that much, plus income taxes. So the poor effectively pay about a 30% tax rate when you count all our taxes. And the rich, who are supposed to pay 39.6%, a lot of their income is capital gains, like gambling on Wall Street. So their effective tax rate is, guess how much? About 15%, all combined. We have the most outrageously regressive tax in the world. A progressive tax, a flat tax is everybody pay 15% or 20%. A progressive tax is the poor pay nothing, super poor pay nothing. The working poor pay like, say, 5% and a little bit higher, 10%, and that the super rich pay 90%, right? Because if you're making $1 million a year or $2 million a year, paying 90% means you still get $200,000 at the end of the at that year. So a progressive tax is like this. A flat tax is like this. We have a regressive tax structure because of our deductions system, where the poor people are wage workers. You don't get deductions if you're a wage worker. If you're a business owner or have business expenses, the capitalist class, then you get deductions. So when you count the deductions, we have a regressive tax structure where the poorest people pay the highest rate and the richest people pay the lowest rate. That's the system we live in. Even a flat tax would be fairer than what we have right now, right? And just remember, your parents and your cousins and your neighbors and your former church members all keep this system going, right? Because our American population is so profoundly ignorant about how things actually work. Yes, Laura?
So I like the terms earned income and unearned income for that, which is synonymous, right? Because when we say higher taxes for the rich as opposed to, or progressive taxes being less taxes for the poor and more for the rich, it sounds charitable. But it's really just the rich aren't doing anything to contribute to society the way they're making that. So to me, it's more commonsensical than even charitable to tax unearned income higher than you would earned income, actually producing a good or a service for the economy.
Right. So why did we cut unearned income? I mean, just think how ridiculous that term is. I mean, it's accurate. But why do we cut unearned income tax from 35% to 20%? Because of the neoliberal assumption that the rich would use that windfall for productive capacity, which, once again, they haven't. To invest more. That was the idea. But they don't. All they do is just get super rich.
Yeah, I think one more point too, and especially when you look at the stock data and things like that too, most of the companies that have like a more exponential rate of return are stuff that doesn't actually have goods and services. You know, like my company, for example, has goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
And then so they make like a, we never like meet our end of year goal, whatever, we have a revenue, and then we have like a return of 5%, 10%, something like that. But then you have banks and you have different credit derivatives, things like that, which has an exponentially huge rate of return, which has like 20, 30, 50% rate of return on their investments. So people who like get these tax credits will be putting their money into these investments, which don't actually produce any goods and services for anybody, but then you get a lot of revenue in return for it.
So for instance, Paul works for a concrete company. And not that they make concrete, but they make stuff that you can hold in your hand, right? And Hikari, I will not say her last name to protect her identity. She works for an abstract company. She works for a multinational bank that doesn't actually produce anything except shuffle money around. And those multinational banks can make profits into the hundreds of percents per year, even thousands, right? That's what neoliberalism is. It's extreme capitalism. It's capitalism on steroids, as we said last week. So the next clause actually addresses what Paul's talking about.
And then the wages, though, of those people, they're not any better. It's only people at the top.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But they work for brick and mortar or something, we can make something they seem to respect their employees and pay them a better wage.
They get better paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even.
You know, one of the ways that people think that they can get themselves out of poverty is by working more.
Mm-hmm.
And payroll taxes negate that as a option. I mean, you might as well, you work 40 hours a week, you make a certain amount, every time you work overtime, the system just takes more of that away from you.
We have perverse incentives.
Yeah, it really is. It's not to your benefit.
If the CEO of Paul's company were really smart, he'd be the head of a bank, right?
Yeah.
maybe he just really loves engineering. Who knows? All right. So the maximum capital gain went down from 35% to 20%. Do you know that from 1980 to 2010, in a 30-year period, Wall Street's share of GDP, that means the financial sector, right? That all they do is just buy and sell financial products, not anything concrete. Their share of GDP went from 5% to 9%. 4% growth. That doesn't sound like much, right? But our economy, our GDP is worth $15 trillion in 1 year. Okay? What is 5% of $15 trillion? $750 billion? Is that right? What is 9% of $15 trillion? Like $1.4 trillion or something, right? $1.45 trillion. So that's like getting, that's like doubling your profits. 100% growth, basically. I mean, what sector of the American economy got a 100% raise? We're happy with a 2 to 3% raise per year. This is what has happened in the financial sector. All right. And then Reagan also deregulated other things. And that's important, too, because deregulation means that corporations make more money. Like, just as an example, our church would have more money in the bank if we didn't have to pay for trash removal and we just threw stuff onto Silver Lake Beach, right, and let somebody else clean that up. So when corporations say we are for deregulation so that we can produce jobs, what they're saying is we don't want rules that are for the common good. We want to be able to dump our waste without paying for it. And then if we have more profit because of that, then we'll create more jobs, which they don't. But that's what they promise. And then the government has to clean up that toxic waste, and that comes from taxpayers' money. So corporations don't want to be regulated, meaning rules and regulations that, you know, keep that are for the common good, so that we taxpayers will pitch in to clean up their waste. Does that sound right? That's our policy. Yes.
In Reagan's deregulation, that also includes things like, you know, before that, refrigerators lasted a long time, appliances, mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, we think something lasts 5 to 7 years or 10 mm-hmm. years if you're really lucky. But before that, things were made last. You know.
Like planned obsolescence?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a real thing. I'm not sure how much that's tied to this era.
Well, it would, if you had more corporate control of the government, it would push for regulations that suit them rather than suit the general interest.
Yep, definitely.
I wanted a Consumer Protection Agency.
Yeah.
Which was heavily attacked during that time period.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think there's some correlation there. Even now, Elizabeth Warren had to fight to restart a Consumer Protection Agency in the government.
Good question. What mm-hmm. about the gold, tying the gold to the money, and is that around this time too, or?
I think in the 1910s, the U.S. went off the gold standard for our domestic economy, okay. And in 1971, Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard in our international trading.
Would that have done with the increase in GDP and stuff too?
That, well, from our research, that has something to do with the recession of 1973. Mm-hmm. So the combination of oil price shock and a money supply that's unmoored from anything real, like gold, meant that there was a tremendous amount of fluctuation and an inability of the U.S. government to inject cash into the system like it did with the Keynesian policy to stabilize it. It wasn't working. But basically, oil prices, there's a number of other factors besides that, but two key factors were getting off the international gold standard and the oil crisis, which caused a tremendous amount of volatility. Yes? Nixon just pronounced it by fiat.
So they stopped buying gold to back up the new currency.
Right.
And
so
they do with the gold at Fort Knox, they just sell it all?
It's just there. It's still there, you know, just in case.
It had more of an effect on other countries than the U.S.
Right.
You know, the purpose of having gold standards is to make it so that the relative value of currencies are relatively stable, so it's harder to play games, taking advantage of their fluctuations. Okay, so, and since the U.S. is really big, it doesn't matter for us too much, but it affects other smaller countries more so. So taking yourself a gold standard is a way of sort of saying, F you, it's the rest of the world, we're going to watch out for us.
Yeah. Well, another way of thinking about it is paper currency, and now electronic currency, right? We don't even use paper anymore. It's just electronically transferred. It's just nothing unless it's based on something. So it used to be based on gold. Even in our domestic market, it wasn't based on gold now for over a century. But at least how are other countries going to trust us if we don't have something like gold? But what we said in 1971 is that the U.S. government will always pay back our debts, whether we have gold or not. Basically, the U.S. said, trust us. And also, but why would any country trust us? Right? Because no one can do anything. Because we have military bases all over the world. And if anybody actually tried to collect, we can just obliterate them. Right? So actually, we went from gold as the backing to our currency to the military as the backing to our currency, right? And that's why, and we're going to kind of get into this, this is why defense is the one area where the neoliberals are demand side, where neoliberals are willing to do old Keynesian economics, just massive amounts of military spending, which is a Keynesian policy, right? Because that's a demand side thing. You just manufacture and buy all this stuff because it actually, even though it's a heavy demand side cost, it actually creates supply side economics all over the world because a U.S. military, the projection of U.S. military power means that neoliberal policies and neoliberal corporations have their way around the world. So it seems like a huge cost to the government, but in terms of empowering the U.S. to live the way we do, which is, by the way, we're very close to $20 trillion of debt. We will never pay this back. I mean, other countries might think they're going to pay it back. We're never going to pay this back. And the only way that we can keep borrowing and not pay back is by having, a military, an unassailable military, basically, right? Yeah. So we have to keep doubling down on our military strength. Because otherwise, the other alternative is to be responsible. Right? Do you see that happening with this government, with our system?
We strengthen one sector and tend to use that to... part of aggressive capitalism is you are constantly pushing the rules to get more and more advantage. So when you strengthen one sector, it pushes for more advantage.
Yep. All right, let's move forward. And I will just do this one last thing before taking a break, the Latin American debt crisis. So now we see the effects of the oil shock in other places. In the 1970s, the oil shock put developing Latin American countries into a liquidity crunch. They were short on cash because so much of their cash was going to oil, right? So where was their money going to come from for basic government services? So they took out loans from large multinational banks, like Wells Fargo, for instance, to get by. But when the U.S. kept raising interest rates, because we had stagflation ourselves at that time, they could no longer make repayments and had to take out even more debt, this time from the International Monetary Fund. During this time, Keynesian economists at the IMF and World Bank were all replaced by neoliberals. Basically trained by the School of Chicago, the Chicago School of Economics, and also at UVA, University of Virginia, and other key places. Adoption of neoliberal policies became a condition for new loans. Desperate countries reluctantly accepted the bitter pill of the IMF's Structural Adjustment Program, SAP, supposedly to help their economies recover, but really to trap them in endless debt repayments to the West. By the late 90s, many of these countries had paid their principal back multiple times and were still behind in their debt payments because of the way interest works. The benefit to the U.S. was new markets, the opportunity for U.S. corporations to buy out state-owned industries, right? Privatization, and the acquisition of resources on the cheap. Mexico was the first country to undergo this new SAP program. From 83 to 88, per capita income in Mexico fell at a rate of about 5% per year, and the value of workers' real wages fell between 40 and 50%. So a devastating effect on entire Latin American countries. That's why the whole era is called Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s. So it was a unbelievable, like a mafia scheme against poor countries. And it says if we don't live on one planet, you know, like it's not going to come back to bite us somehow. But the super rich always think that they're one step ahead of everybody else. And then we see that they basically bankrupt our whole economy and then know that they can get away with it. Because if we let them be bankrupted, like was it Lehman Brothers that the U.S. government allowed to go bankrupt, it could bring the entire financial system down. So our economy is not based on anything real, like gold or industries or land, anything real. It's just based on the threat of American power. So if our economy collapses, then it collapses because of a lack of faith in America's ability to pay its debts, right? And to keep this thing going. So we're basically operating on confidence, like believing that this will keep working forever.
Does that make us a con man? Con is short for confidence.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why we all need to have alternate plans, right? But we saw that in 2008, people's retirement accounts were wiped out. Remember that? And people who thought they're going to retire at 67 had to keep working another 7-8 years to just try to get things back on track. Our economy is just as fake now as it was back then. So when enough things happen and people lose confidence in this balloon that we have that we call the economy and it pops in some way, then all of that could disappear again. So I'm not saying that there's a better alternative. I mean, even cash, like instead of putting it in our bank, we can put cash, you know, under our mattress. But that cash, the worth of that cash depends on where we are in the economy. So
it's all connected.
And land prices can go up and down depending on the economy. So that's where we are.
So fully stocked bomb shelters.
Fully stocked bomb shelters, yes. Babatope, just one more comment and then we'll take a break.
Sure. I was just going to comment about the Latin American crisis. Actually affected Nigeria as well. Nigeria was in 85. The IMF actually imposed. We had a military junta who was the head of Nigeria then, and he's actually the current president right now, Buhari. When he was there in 1985, the IMF came with structural adjustment program, so they were going to impose the program on Nigeria, so he rejected it. So now we're not going to do this. So they sponsored a guy, Ibrahim Babangida, who took over, overthrew him, and he came into power. So, and he adopted the structural adjustment program. So basically, they are Salvador Allende of a Pinochet, scenario happened again.
Happened in Nigeria.
Right.
Wow.
And the structural adjustment program was implemented, which devastated the economy. And for the first time in the history of Nigeria, the dollar was more than the naira. And that started in 1985.
Wow.
And so right now, a dollar to naira, depending on the rate, is actually like 450 naira.
Wow. Wow.
All right. Good to know. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. Okay. In the 1990s, neoliberalism becomes the norm. In 1980, it was a novelty, but in 1990, it's the norm. I would say that Ronald Reagan's charismatic leadership likely shifted the entire ideological spectrum dramatically to the right in the 1980s. What do I mean by that? By the 92 election, voters had the choice between Bush Sr.'s Republican neoliberalism or Bill Clinton's Democratic neoliberalism.
But is it really ideology? Could it not just be a weakened union meant that the Bill Clinton only elected by chasing after the same rents as Republicans?
Without a viable economic alternative except for reheated Keynesianism, microwaved, Democrats faced an identity crisis. Their salvation came from a group of New Democrats who, in the midst of the Republican Revolution of 1994, outflanked the Republicans from the right, advancing the interests of multinational corporations and reviving racially regressive policies that appeal to old Dixiecrats and Republicans. Do you all know what Dixiecrats are? They're racist Democrats. For real. We still, believe it or not, we still had Dixiecrats in 1994. There are basically no Dixiecrats left. Why? Because they all converted and saw the light and stopped being racist?
Amen.
Yes.
Didn't most of them convert?
They did convert, but not in a good way. They they became Republicans. Right. So get this. When I was in college, I was very active in a particular political party. I will not say which one. But we had only, out of 13 Congress people, we only had one Republican in Georgia. His name was Newt Gingrich. Okay? And do you know right now it's like 12 out of 13 or 11 out of 13 Republican? That does not mean, you know, that people's affections or orientation changed all that much. It means that the Democrats, which housed Southern racists who longed for the days of the Confederacy, just switched loyalties from Democrat to Republican. They stopped being Dixiecrats and became Republicans. That strategy was begun by Richard Nixon, the law and order candidate. It was called the Southern Strategy. It was a strategy to convert Dixiecrats into Republicans. And Nixon started it. It was greatly advanced by Ronald Reagan. And then it basically was finished. That whole thing, that whole project was done by 1994, Republican Revolution of Newt Gingrich. Got it? Nixon, Reagan, Gingrich. That's how a complete conversion of Southern racist Democrats became Republicans. You're welcome. So, with the Cold War over in 1991, both parties welcomed a new foreign enemy to end the Vietnam Syndrome. You know, the 80s was a decade where we still felt bad about losing the Vietnam War. Remember that? And 1991, Gulf War won, which was like watching video games. It was awesome. You didn't see blood. You just saw neon flickers in the night with a night vision. And you saw, you know, like these kind of, just like video games. And then the whole thing blowing up. And then we were told in the news, these are precision-guided missiles. And they were surgical attacks. Oh, my goodness. War has become antiseptic. Right? War became clean. War became precise. And when some people actually got killed that weren't supposed to get killed, we call that collateral damage. Wow, that's not so bad. You know, people getting murdered, that's one thing, but just collateral damage? So, this Gulf War I basically got us Americans our mojo back, right? Korean War ended in a stalemate. Vietnam War, we outright lost to a bunch of jungle dwellers. I'm sorry for being so racist as a fellow Asian. But Gulf War I We got all our technology, and it worked. And we got Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait and drove him from here, where he was trying to steal this little tiny country's oil, and drove him all the way back to Baghdad. But, you know, Bush Jr. said, "Dad, why didn't you just kill the guy? Finish him off. I'm the finisher. I'm the decider." We thought he had a poor command of the English language, you see. That's what we get for making fun of George Bush Jr. We got Trump. Is there any way to butcher the English language further? Let's not even ask that. Okay. So we ended the Vietnam syndrome and demonstrated a new American military supremacy. Economic neolibs and military neocons worked hand in hand to make sure no country would dare threaten U.S. interests, the sole global superpower. So the new imperialism and the Crusades Redux, 1991. There was a shifting balance of power between multinational corporations and nation-states in the new neoliberal framework. But huge MNCs, multinational corporations, in the U.S. still depended on the U.S. government to impose their policies on the rest of the world. Financial diplomatic pressures were not always sufficient. When the client state of Iraq turned against its master in 1990 by invading Kuwait for oil, Bush Sr. led an international coalition that ousted Iraq from Kuwait. The message was clear that Middle East countries are not to circumscribe U.S. oil companies' interests, and to demonstrate that the U.S. is the only superpower left and thus the world's sole policeman. With the Cold War over, Gulf War I set the stage for a clash of civilizations between the West and Islam. Right back to the Crusades. See, you know, like you keep all your clothes because the fashion returns, right? That's the lesson. Is it? So we had this war, Cold War, between the U.S. and the USSR, and we need a new enemy. For what reason? To keep American workers and American corporations on the same side again, right? Because after the Cold War, we were promised a peace dividend. How many of us remember that term, peace dividend, right? Some of us were old enough to remember that phrase. And as we said earlier, there was a peace dividend because defense spending went down dramatically. We were no longer actually making nuclear weapons. We actually were diffusing nuclear weapons, getting rid of them with a nuclear deal with a formerly Soviet Union. So there was a peace dividend, but it went all to the top. So we're like, what the heck? And then the U.S. went to war with Iraq. And they said, that the heck, right? Look at there, that the heck. What? If my president can butcher the English language, so can I, okay? So stop judging us. Me and Trump were like, okay, so where were we? Oh, the heck, that's where we were. So we're fighting now a war on terror, which means the West versus Islam, which is the same thing as the Middle Ages, the Crusades. And so it's the most ridiculous thing. Remember that Islam was our what during the Cold War? Our ally. Islam broadly was an ally to America against the Soviet Union. Did we forget? When the Soviet Union became a neoliberal ally through Boris Yeltsin's incompetence, when there is incompetence, neoliberal capitalist economics will fill the void of incompetence, right? Then, how do we keep things together? How do all of us who are, you know, how do we cover over the exploitation by creating a common enemy? I don't know if we mentioned this last week, but there's levels at which the U.S. Coerces other nations economically. Did we talk about this last week? First, the U.S. uses pressure by corporations themselves. Corporations go in and say, you know, we'll give you a cut to the ruling class if you let us go in and exploit your resources and just dump everything. Of course, they never say they're going to dump everything. They just say, trust us, right? And we have money, and we're technologically sophisticated, and we'll extract all that, and then we'll cover it over with a beautiful park, you know, or a golf course, things like that. In any case, you'll get a cut. If they don't succumb to MNC's pressure, then next is State Department pressure. Did you know that our State Department, which is our diplomatic wing, has what in the not too long ago was called economic hitmen? Yep. Right? So they don't have guns. They're not military trained. But they are trained in neoliberal economics. And they go in and apply soft pressure and say, okay, would you like to stay in power and get a cut of this corporate wheeling and dealing, or would you like to be overthrown and have somebody else get the cut instead of you, right? And, I mean, I'm not saying that that will or will not happen, but that has happened in other countries. So the State Department sends economic hitmen on behalf of American corporate interests. And if they don't give in to that, then the CIA goes in. And CIA does pack. And the CIA can create airplane accidents and car accidents and suicides on a regular basis, right? And they will invent drug overdoses and all kinds of things. So by the time we get the CIA involved, we're talking about, like, assassinations. And if that doesn't work, because sometimes even that doesn't work, then the military can actually go in and invade, like, invade. Oh, before that, we will use proxy armies, like in Nicaragua, right? The Sandinistas or other proxies. And if our proxy military doesn't work, then we'll go and invade ourselves directly, like Panama or Afghanistan or Iraq. Do you see the stages? So the U.S. has a whole range of tools to apply pressure to get these countries to open up to our exploitation. And you can do it easy or you can do it hard. Those are the only choices that the U.S. gives to countries that we want to exploit. Susie.
Did you see that Colombia was in the news and the president had a press conference with Trump? And he's like, yeah, we're going to have infrastructure. We're going to build roads for the peasants. And I was just like, we just talked about this in class.
What cut is he going to get, right? He and his family and his cronies.
Santos has done lots of great things for Colombia.
But on the other hand, I'm not talking about this particular situation, this particular person. In a situation like this, which is very common, if he doesn't comply with the U.S., then we're just going to... It's very easy to overthrow these people with all the tools at our disposal. Paul?
I think also right after the war ends or whatever, even with World War II, with the Nazi regime disbanded and everything, all the people of power were pretty much actually well taken care of. They got amnesty. All these scientists and engineers and everybody from the Nazi regime, they were the ones who actually invented rockets.
Mm.
And they were the ones who were well taken care of. They were brought to the U.S. and they built our infrastructure, our like modern infrastructure and all that. Even with the Vietnam War or the Korean War, even all the genocides and ecocides that happened in the rest of the world, those people who do that and who promote that and who are like smart enough to do all that kind of stuff, they're brought here.
Mm-hmm.
And they run the country now, in a way. All the scientists, all right. That kind of stuff there too. So, and even with the Iran-Iraq war, everything, like whatever, the key people of power, even when they lost, you know, when they surrendered or whatever, the people who, they have to give up something to be able to get their, you know, underlings or whatever to, like, stop fighting, and then they get amnesty, and then they're well taken care of.
You know what was the most awesome thing about Gulf War I? Stealth fighters and bombers. Was that cool or what? How can you not be patriotic looking at those stealth bombers and fighters? All right.
What's the last thing you're
going to
say?
No. Oh, here's another interesting factoid. We call it the Vietnam War, right?
Yeah.
You know what the Vietnamese call it? The American War. That's what they call it. Okay. Ran out of trivia. So I'm going to have to just keep keep going. All right. So NAFTA, 1994. In 94, Clinton, who had been in office for about 2 years, pushed NAFTA through Congress, basically shoved it down their throat, giving multinational corporations sovereignty over governments. How about that? Sovereignty over governments. Even allowing them to sue governments for damages caused by regulations, which is very much what the TPP is doing even more, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Obama tried to get passed and that Trump spoke against, but now is...
So he canceled it, right? You had executive order.
Probably changed the name.
Yeah, something's happening, yeah. It created massive suffering in Mexico, increasing immigration to the U.S. while hurting the U.S. working class through outsourced and migrant labor. In Mexico, 1.8 million farmers were displaced and extreme rural poverty shot up to 55%. NAFTA also made the American working class extremely vulnerable by placing them in direct competition with outsourced and migrant labor. So a little bit about NAFTA. It was a trade deal between Canada, U.S., and Mexico, and it basically meant that tariffs would be lowered or eliminated altogether. But one of the major problems is Mexico is still very much an agrarian economy, meaning farm-based, right, whereas the U.S. is not. U.S. farming is one of the most heavily subsidized parts of our national economy. How many of you knew that? Okay, right. Oil, fossil fuels, is another heavily welfareized part of our economy. So farmers, whether they're corporate farmers or, you know, family farmers, get subsidies and incentives and all kinds of things to grow certain things, like corn or soybean, very popular. And because of the way that farming works and because of welfare or subsidies for growing certain things, our sugar beets, our corn, our wheat, other things are lower priced than wheat and corn in other parts of the world. One of the major reasons, I mean, part of it is efficiency. We do have high technology, and it's terrible because we also use chemicals that ruin the environment. But in any case, in terms of yield, there's high productivity in this country. But also welfare, government welfare. So the U.S. government is able to provide welfare to our farming, our agricultural sector, that other countries simply can't match. Because we have the money? No, because we can do it through debt, right? We can borrow and put that money into our agricultural sector in ways that other countries simply can't. Because if any other country tried to be $20 trillion in debt, no one's going to buy that, and we will just let those economies go bankrupt like Greece or Iceland even a few years ago, right? Other countries will go bankrupt if they took on the same kind of economic irresponsibility that we did. But thankfully, we have a military, right? So now American farm products are flooding into Mexico, subsidized, whereas Mexican government cannot subsidize their farm products. So if a Mexican person could buy corn at, say, $2, a Mexican corn for $2, or American corn for $1, what would an average Mexican do? Obviously buy it for a lot cheaper. So countless farmers lost their jobs in the subsistence farming that they did, because they could not compete with American welfare to its agricultural sector. Those people then worked in factories that the U.S., because of NAFTA, was setting up all along the border and into the interior too. So then they could totally undercut manufacturing job labor costs compared to, say, Detroit or Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Duluth, Minnesota, because these poor farmers would work for any wage compared to not having any job at all. So manufacturing. So the U.S. can pay a Ford factory worker a certain amount in Detroit, or they could build a factory in Mexico and pay a Mexican worker a fraction of the cost. So that's going to lower manufacturing costs for U.S. automakers. And where does all that profit go? Back to the workers? No. American manufacturing jobs were lost. Mexican manufacturing jobs were gained, but they were still dirt poor, and they lost their real jobs, which was farming. Right? So it devastated workers in both countries, and all that profit just went to the capitalist class. And that's why there was so much anger about NAFTA among the working people, whether they were farmers or others.
NAFTA would be better for Mexico because a lot of Mexico's wealth is concentrated by families. However, the corporations from America, while it allowed some freedoms to emerge, they more or less, you know, ended up being just as corrupting as the five big families were. And so there still wasn't adequate job creation being done. And it was just really hard to find great jobs for all these displaced small corn farmers from southern Mexico.
Also, if manufacturing was even slightly less expensive in China or somewhere else, those manufacturing jobs that moved from Detroit to Mexico then moved to China, right? So now these people who used to be farmers, then were factory workers, now are completely unemployed. They have nothing. So the great migration, you know, across the Rio Grande, across the border. And now they're working here as our hotel cleaning people, as our landscapers, what else? Meat packing, especially farm workers, seasonal farm workers.
There are a lot of people just doing meat, like that was their industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Mexico got flooded with like U.S. products.
Right.
And they go and they do the exact same job, but in a factory in the U.S.
Right. Right. So the U.S. is the U.S. shoving NAFTA down our Congress throat. Mexico basically has created this immigration crisis. We created this crisis by destroying Mexican workers' jobs through unfair competition. If it were even fair competition, that'd be one thing. But we subsidize, meaning we give welfare to our agricultural sector in ways that other countries simply cannot because they cannot go into debt like we can because they don't have the military that we do, right? It is just so incredibly unfair. It's gangsterism. Okay, I mean, how much more plainly can I say this? The United States is a state-sponsored terrorist and gangster that gets its way through military intimidation.
One promise that was made to Mexicans was more competition is going to mean more efficiency, which is going to mean lower prices on everything that you buy. But, like, especially one classic example of that is like corn tortillas, which is like just a staple. It's like white bread. But once corporations, U.S. corporations like Walmart, had undercut the Mexican agricultural industry, they basically ended up with a monopoly. And so they can set the prices however they want. There's no one to compete with them at that point. So actually prices rose 50% after NAFTA on corn tortillas. Yeah, a few years later.
Yeah. All right, and we'll talk about one other thing, and then we'll take some do some Q&A. The Asian financial crisis, which Korean people simply call the IMF crisis. In the late 80s and early 90s, Western nations cajoled the miracle economies, also called the tiger economies, of East and Southeast Asia to open up their financial sectors to Wall Street-style trading and speculation. That would be Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, because it was kind of semi-independent from China, and Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore. So foreign capital flooded in, causing an inflation of asset prices, right? All of this Wall Street speculative money comes into the Korean Stock Exchange. And what do you do with that? You buy up assets, businesses, office buildings, just homes even, just regular real estate. Soon an asset bubble emerged. I mean, in Korea, I remember this time in the 90s, people were becoming instant millionaires. And we were like, holy cow, why did we come to the United States? All we had to do was just keep that house that we owned in the early 1970s and sell it for like $800,000, a house that would have cost $30,000. I kid you not, right? Like, our family was in Songbukdong, and that house today, and it's still there, by the way. They didn't build an apartment high-rise. It would be easily worth close to $1 million today. I could have been that millionaire.
You were the millionaire you were looking for all along.
Where's the mirror? So soon an asset bubble emerged with prices ballooning grotesquely out of proportion to their actual value based on financial speculation a la Wall Street hedge funds. In 1997, when Bangkok unpegged the Thai baht from the U.S. dollar, the bubble burst there first, and then foreign money was withdrawn and the crisis hit. In South Korea, for example, unemployment rose to 10%. It used to be like 3-point-something%, leading to a near economic collapse. To receive a bailout from the IMF, however, governments were forced to accept austerity measures, the structural thing, you know. The IMF crisis was the first inkling that neoliberalism as economic theory might be faulty at best and destructive at worst. So now the whole economic theory of neoliberalism was questioned, not just application, you know, but like the thing itself. And I think the 97 crisis was the first wake-up call around the world where especially smaller economies were not just going to bite the bait of neoliberal institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. So I especially want us to think about NAFTA because we're right here in North America and we're still talking about it. It's still, we still feel the effects of that. But any questions about how neoliberalism really advanced in the 90s because of the foundation laid by Thatcher and Reagan?
I'm just wondering if you want to touch on, because this got pulled out the Glass-Steagall Act as well during Trump's presidency.
Yes. Oh, that's great. In 1999, Clinton, along with Senate Republicans, repealed Glass-Steagall. Remember what happened financially in 1929? The crash of Wall Street in 1929. That leads immediately to the Great Depression. The president of the United States at that time can't seem to do anything using old monetary policy. FDR comes in, borrowing ideas from the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, and starts to inject money to create demand and jobs. So it works a little bit. It wasn't a big enough stimulus to a lot of economists. But one of the things that FDR does is that 1 year after he's elected in 1933, he gets through Congress the Glass-Steagall Act, which basically separates commercial banking from investment banking, basically a separation of church and state. So commercial banking is what most of us do. When we borrow money, or when we put deposits, that's commercial banking, right? If you get a mortgage, car loan, even a small business loan, or even a big business loan, that's mostly commercial banking. But investment banking is what Wall Street is famous for. And they take big money and they basically gamble with it and pick winners and losers in the global stock market. So the problem with allowing one bank to have a commercial and investment arm is that you can take commercial loans and then gamble with it on the investment side. You see what I'm saying? So you take real loans based on real assets like cars, boats, houses, and then you can bundle them and then use that for speculation where you know profits can skyrocket because it's gambling. So those church and state were separated by Roosevelt in 1933. Clinton, working in concert with Senate Republicans, because he's a new Democrat, right, brought church and state together again. And so now our mortgages, basically, because mortgages are our biggest loans for the average consumer, right? Because then easily, if a house costs $250,000, that's a $225,000 loan we took out that we're supposed to pay back in 30 years. With interest, that's a huge amount of money. That, your mortgage and my mortgage and your mortgage and you know, thousands of people's mortgages are put together. If you put that kind of loan amount together, that one fund could be worth tens of millions of dollars. Then you take that big money, tens of millions or hundreds of millions even, and then you sell that as shares. And a share can cost $100 each, right? And then people can't afford a $250,000 mortgage, much less this huge bundled mortgage product, but people can afford a $100 share price, right? And they might buy four or five shares for $500, keep investing. So they securitized it, meaning turned it into shares of stock. And then all kinds of people are buying this, corporations, individuals, governments, and then that rises in value. And then that the rise in the securitization of mortgages also meant real price rises in our houses, except it was a bubble. Much of the rise was because Wall Street, after the Glass-Steagall was repealed, bundled our mortgages and sold it to speculators on Wall Street. Yes?
How did it work before Glass-Steagall was repealed? Because I know mortgage-backed securities date back to like the 70s.
Yes.
So how did they draw that line of demarcation so that...
I think that more banks were able to get in on it. And, take advantage of the speculation than they were before. And that put more of us at risk.
I think the simple answer is scale. I mean, billions and billions of dollars now could be poured into that kind of thing because you have a pool of money that you didn't have before. So, yeah, the wealthy could speculate. I mean, some of the investment banks could put some of this stuff together. But basically, the big wall was torn down. So this just became, very, very easy to do.
So it's more about the banks than it is about other things like pension funds or...
Yeah, the banks were the ones gambling the most, not pension funds.
Right. Susie?
I have a question. We're constantly seeing the news, like, we're heading for another housing bubble or something like that. It's still scary in everybody because, people lost their values overnight.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess... hypothetically, my house has raised $30,000 in the last year and a half. And I just keep thinking, how much is that as real value? I mean, that can't be, real money. You know what I mean? That's, perceived.
Right.
And that could burst tomorrow.
Right. And if it does, let's say it bursts tomorrow, and it erases, say your $30,000 gain is erased, and it even goes down 10,000 more. It doesn't really matter as long as you and Jim Bear have your employment intact and you can pay the mortgage, right? It doesn't really matter. One of the major problems that arose in the 90s and 2000s was that banks were pushing second mortgages and lines of credit based on your mortgage like crazy. Adjustable rate mortgage was another thing. Interest rate mortgage. I mean, every kind of financial shenanigan imaginable with mortgages. So you can take out a second mortgage if you have that much collateral in the property. So let's say your house cost $250,000 and you put 10% down. So you have $25,000 of your money collateral in there. But let's say in 5 years, the property went from $250,000 to $350,000. So you already put $25,000 in there. In 5 years, you're paid down your principal, maybe another, $15,000. So $25,000 plus principal for 5 years, $40,000. And then your house rose in value by $100,000. From the bank's point of view, based on what it can sell for today, you have $140,000 of equity. You really only have $40,000 in equity, but because the market bubble rose by another $100,000, you have $140,000. The bank will say, you can actually borrow another $100,000 if you want. We'll let you borrow the capital gain on your house. So then you take out a second mortgage on that $100,000, and you buy a boat, and you build that dream cabin up north. You know who you are, Minnesotans. I know your dreams. And then that I'm for. And And we have jobs, the economy is growing, and we got those raises along the way. And then the economy crashes in 2008, right? And a lot of us lost our jobs. We have two mortgages now, and we can't pay it back. And then we're trying to sell the house. But the house is worth, not only is it not worth $350, it's not worth $250. It's worth $180 now. And even if we sold the house, we don't have enough money to sell it, basically. Because all of the money that comes to us doesn't add up to what we'll get for us. This is called an upside-down mortgage. Millions upon millions of people found themselves in an upside-down mortgage in 2008, 2009, 2010, as the bubble burst in the housing market, right? And just a little bit of background before that, there was a tech bubble, also called the dot-com bubble, in the late 90s, where Google was coming up and Yahoo and all kinds of companies that we forgot now, right? There were so many search engines at the time. Now it's like Google and Yahoo, but there was a time when there were like 30-plus search engines that had real potential. And so much money went into the tech sector, and then that was a bubble that burst between 2000 and 2002, and those people that still had some money left put that money into real estate. They said real estate's a sure thing. And again, remember, the bursting of the tech bubble coincided with Glass-Steagall's repeal in 1999. See that? So all of this money that came out of tech now could go into real estate, not just direct real estate, but real estate securitization, which means turning our mortgages into stocks, shares of stock. So the housing market just ballooned from 2000 to 2006. And then the big players, it's like, this is definitely a balloon, started to pull out. So housing prices kind of stabilized in 2007 because the big players knew what was going on. In 2008, a complete collapse, right? So are we in a bubble or not? That's a good question. Some people think that we are. But one of the things that the U.S. has going for it is constant population increase because of immigration, both legal and undocumented. So there is a demand for housing. But the real question is our employment. Whether no matter what happens to our asset price on the market, whether we can make the monthly payment on the mortgage, right? And then if we actually don't have a mortgage payment, then it kind of becomes moot, you know? Which is why mortgage debt is generally the safest debt for the average consumer because it's leveraged, meaning there's an asset behind it. And usually in non-bubble economic situations, it will rise incrementally by a few percentage points every year. But you know, like if you use a realtor, it's typically 5-6% of your housing value. So if you buy a house, you really need it to increase by 5-6% before you sell it so that you can just break even after realtor cost.
Housing has not been a great investment compared with your average return and the variability return. Compared with like pulling stocks or other things, mm-hmm. It's not that great investment. But it's generally forced people to save.
Right.
And people are bad savers. So buying a house has been a way of making yourself save, which has been, of course, a lifesaver.
Right, putting equity in something tangible. And let's just define, like, say, leveraged debt from unleveraged debt or collateralized debt versus uncollateralized debt. An auto loan is actually like a car loan. An auto loan is like a mortgage. And what I said just now is also true. Yeah, but
auto loan is like a mortgage.
Yeah. Right. Because when you take an auto loan, there's a car behind it. But you know, when you drive it off a new car lot, it depreciates by 30% typically, whereas houses remain relatively stable. Also, if you get a loan on a consumer product like a computer, that's also a collateralized loan, but that's a terrible investment because your computer, your brand new computer, is almost worthless as soon as you use it one day. So just because it's collateralized or has asset behind it doesn't mean it's necessarily a good loan. An uncollateralized debt, unleveraged debt, is like credit card loans, which I think are the worst, but also educational loan, Now, educational loan has no collateral behind it. It's just thin air. But if you bring real skill, like you learn something real, like engineering, like Paul Moses, then you might actually do something with that. But if you major in English, then what's the point? What's the point? Look at Donald Trump, right? You can become president in America without knowing how to speak English. This is a wonderful country, right? So. Oh, that's a trick that our economy put over us.
Follow you through bankruptcy because they're uncollateralized.
That's right.
Five. They wanted it in order to encourage.
Oh, and they can't take it away.
Right. Yeah. They, in order to
yes, Nancy.
To lend to you, rather than finding a different way like many other countries and just making the yep. cost lower, the government set it up so that there's a way for companies to make money off of you.
Right.
But
we've set up also our system that people, even if they have skill, you really can't get a job mm-hmm. that would enable you to buy a house or anything yep. unless you have a degree of it.
Right.
So.
Right. That's true too. Susie?
Okay. So medical debt, is that secured or unsecured? Because I've heard that could follow you through bankruptcy as well.
Unsecured.
Yeah, that's unsecured.
Okay, so they made it so that even if you like survive the cancer, they mm-hmm. can get their money.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe like it'd be good to clarify something about the housing, the mortgage thing too. Like, you know, first initially, I think before this Glass-Steagall thing or whatever, like loans were, you know, they were incentivized because you were able to like earn an interest on it. That's kind of why banks were incentivized. People were incentivized to buy loans and things like that. But the issue with combining both was CDOs, like collateral debt obligations, where they were able to make bets on the loans itself. So you take these loans, you bundle them all together, and then you have $100 million value or whatever, you know. And they're able to take derivatives off of that, and the derivative is an exponential added risk to it.
Mm-hmm.
You take those exponential risk, and then you make it $1 billion loan or $1 billion investment, and you can get a return of 10 times that. So you make like you can get like a $1.2 billion, $1.5 billion return on $100 million actual thing. So because of that, when all of these were bundled together and pulled together and put into something, and then if a place in Florida collapses, for example, like a small collapse there, exponentially destroys
mm-hmm.
everything in its
mm-hmm.
path. That was the biggest problem with the financial crisis,
right.
Financial risk was because they just destroyed like a small collapse of one thing will just like completely crumble down
right.
everything else. It's almost like a tear-down effect or whatever.
It's a house of cards. It's a legalized Ponzi scheme. The federal government should have regulations that say that kind of risky gambling in our economy is not good. It doesn't do anything. It has no productive value. It allows a few people to get super rich, and it also makes a lot of people super poor if they lose. It does nothing for our economy. So the government needs to step in and say, we're not going to do that. That doesn't help anything. But neoliberalism says free market. Free market means anybody can gamble. Now, if in gambling, winners win and losers lose, that makes sense. But in our system, we can't have losers lose, or else the entire house of cards comes down. In 2007, Lehman Brothers was allowed to go bankrupt. That caused a ripple effect of all kinds of other institutions going bankrupt. Right, in a similar way that Paul described with CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, that way. And then that was about to bring the entire global financial economic system with Wall Street at the center down. Then that means real jobs are lost, real houses are lost, real retirements are emptied out. I mean, like that has real effect. So all of this is propped up by confidence in the economy, by our U.S. military, by all kinds of promises that we've made. For instance, that the U.S. as a republic will last forever. As long as we exist as a functioning government and republic forever, we will always be able to pay the interest payments that we owe by borrowing from the future and paying the past, right? So we can meet our obligations as long as we exist. But every republic has come to an end at some point. And if we go bankrupt at any time and we're allowed to go bankrupt, because of the ways that we have infiltrated every economy in the world, now Russia, our former enemy, China, our former enemy, everybody is part of the American neoliberal economic system. We have a complete collapse. So other countries can't even call our bluff, call our loans, because their economy would collapse too. So it's like, you know, you've ever seen a movie where everybody has a gun pointed at the next person? You know, everyone's got a gun pointed at each other. That's where we are. But but our economy is not based on anything real at this point. So it's the whole thing is basically a bubble. So the question is it going to be a bigger bubble or a smaller bubble? Will the bubble expand or contract? That, you know, those are guesses. So even though it's like racism, right? Racism at the conceptual level is not real. Like, white people is not a real thing. It's a fake sociological construct to manipulate power dynamics. Black people, you know, Asian people, like, this is completely strange constructs, but it has a real effect. So we have to talk about it for real. We have to deconstruct it for real. We have to resist it for real because it has real effects. But the thing itself is fake. It's just like our economy. It's completely fake, but it has real effects. Like that fake economy that burst in 2008 caused millions of people to lose their jobs, to lose their homes, and to lose their retirement accounts. See what I'm saying? Racism has real effects. Our neoliberal economic system has real effects and real people's lives. And that's why we have to understand it. And that's why we have to resist it. And that's why we have to come up with a new economic system. Next week, we're really going to talk this through more discussion style. But one of the major things that we have to do is come up with an economic system that includes the environment at the center of our economic calculus. Neither Marxist economics, it gives some lip service to it, but doesn't really take the earth into consideration, and definitely capitalism does not. It pretends that the earth is an inexhaustible resource and an inexhaustible dumping ground, which is completely mad, right? That is simply not the case. And that's why I think there's so many fantasies right now about going to Mars, right? We trash Earth, and then we just escape. This is a classic Western fantasy, Western escapism. Always dump and trash everything and then go somewhere else, right? No, this is our home. We've got to make this work. So we need an economic theory, an economic system that is sustainable, that is healthy, that allows freedom for individuals and freedom for communities collectively, that protects human dignity and human flourishing. We need a new economic system. The old ones have all failed. And that's what our congregation must do. We have to save the world.
In a low anxiety way.
In a low anxiety way. With Jesus' help, right? Cannot be done on our own. But we just don't. The best we have is mitigating our destructiveness, like reducing our destructive power at best.
That's not the best we can do.
That is definitely not. So we need some, and this is not the kind of thing that economists can solve by themselves. They're in it too deeply, right? All kinds of creative people in all kinds of different sectors of society with all kinds of different ways of seeing things, all kinds of cultures, and every single gender all need to come together and see if we can come up with a different way to organize our life together. We can't go back, I mean, most of us, to hunting and gathering, but how can we nevertheless move in a direction that does not lead us to the obvious end of self-genocide, basically, the end of human life as we know it. All right, thank you all. And Myung-chan, would you say a closing prayer for us?
Dear Father, thank you so much for giving us a great lesson today. We learned a lot of economics in history. And I believe the root cause is our greedy mind.
Yes.
our receptionist and destroyed our relationship with the Earth and the other nations and all our resources. And please hear us so that we can recover all relationship, and also we can consider that this is a wonderful place you give us as a gift, and we can keep this place well, that we can, that is the mission to live here. And please be with us. And thank you so much for a great lesson from Pastor Xin. And we have one more lesson. And we'll be, have a good discussion on the lesson. Please be with us. We pray this in Jesus Christ's name.
Amen. Thank you all.